Mr. Oxley, reel 2.
Now, at this time when you were working in Woolwich, do you remember whether there was any talk about things like profiteering, people making money out of the war, things like that?
No. I can't recall that at all. The war was accepted that you were in the forces, and that was that, and if you were on armaments, that was that.
I can remember old soldiers I've talked to who said that they'd come home on leave with their soldiers' pay and they'd be a bit cheesed off that, you know, they'd have so little money, and contemporaries of theirs who were working in the munitions industries would have lots of money to flash around.
No, I think that was an afterthought after the war.
You do?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. If I may recount on that, a man who came back on leave, his time would be taken up with visiting relatives or his family, and he would never be introduced to outside life. His time would be so short to kind of form any comparison. And I'm sure that observation there was done after the war.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I've heard of occasions where people would meet fellows who were friends of theirs before they went into the service, and because they were local chaps, it would be quite natural to go out and have a beer with them
in the pub,
and then the money would come out, and this, I get the impression, sometimes caused a little ill feeling. But you never came across any of that?
No, I did not.
No. While you were at Woolwich, was there a very high incidence of air raids or air raid warnings?
There wasn't a high incidence of air raid warnings, but when they did take place, the whole of the area was blacked out.
Now, exactly what was the drill? I mean, what kind of alarm would be given, and then what would the drill be?
Being in the factory, one would not hear the outside warnings, which these people outside the factories had warnings of, and they were what they call maroons. And a maroon was a kind of a rocket sent up which gave an explosion. But you wouldn't hear them in the factory. But the warning would be given by the foreman of the factory. All the machine would be shut down, and you simply take shelter wherever you could. The whole of the place would be blacked out, and that was that.
How did they black the place out?
No lights whatsoever.
Were there any air raid shelters?
None.
Where would you go then?
Being adjacent to the riverside, we'd go down to the riverside.
Are there any particular air raids which stand out in your mind, any that you can remember as being events?
Yes, one is very vivid in my mind. This particular Zeppelin stood over the arsenal with the searchlights on it, which kind of superimposed it against the background of the night sky, and there was rather a panic. Everyone started to rush around, taking whatever shelter they could. Majority of them went to the riverside, because they thought that there was only bombs dropping, if they dropped in the water, there wouldn't be any, what should we say, results from them, you see. And at this particular night, they did drop bombs in the vicinity of the arsenal, and one or two inside. And whether I was subjected to the result of a bomb being dropped, but I woke up and found myself in the hospital in the arsenal, and it was a slight concussion.
Where had you actually been at the time the bomb dropped and you felt and you were concussed?
I wasn't in the factory, I was on the outside. We were kind of running around in a form of panic to try to find some kind of shelter. But there was no shelters whatsoever in the manner of what we knew them in the Second World War.
Now, we've talked about work. I'd like to talk about your home life during this period before you went into the service.
Yes.
Can you think of any particular ways in which the fact that there was a war on affected your home life, your family life, your social life?
Well, my people were in business at the time, and I'd come home from the arsenal, very much fatigued. And when one was on day work, you'd come home, well, I'd be arriving home about 9 o'clock. I'd be so fatigued that to sit down for a meal, I'd fall asleep, which was, speaking to friends of mine in afterlife, they all experienced the same. It was contingent to the amount of hours one was spending inside a factory. But as regards my home life, one would be subjected to the air raid wardens, and there was no shelters as such. You simply take shelter in the house.
Where would you take shelter in the house?
Well, we all felt if we got into the passage near a dividing wall, that was as much shelter as you wanted. Mm.
Were you given any official instructions about what to do if an air raid took place when you were in your own homes?
There were air raid wardens, voluntary, who would come round on bicycles shouting out, "Take cover." But there was no specific shelters to take cover in. You only took cover in your own particular dwelling.
And there were no official handouts, leaflets or anything telling you what to do in the event of an air raid?
It was done by voluntary workers and police, on the police, yes.
Any other effects on you that the war had on your home life? What about food, for example?
Oh, food became very scarce. As the war dragged on, food became very scarce, and there was a lot of embarrassment as regards the ladies or the women folk of the house lining up for their husbands or children for food.
Where and how would they do that? What was the drill there?
Well, the particular shop, according to whatever their produce they were selling, they had so much to sell, and you line up for it.
Was there coupons, or was it just first come, first served?
There's no coupons, no.
Was it just first come, first served?
In effect, yes. And of course, if you were, say, well known to a particular purveyor, that particular produce, it was a bit of under the counter work.
Was there any limitations on how much particular shops would sell you? I mean, did the shops themselves try and share it out evenly?
I think that is quite a good question. I think it was relative to the particular the shopkeeper, the amount of stuff he was able to acquire.
Now, you said there were food shortages.
Yeah.
Was it a case of there being less food overall, or was it a case of there being some kinds of things you couldn't get?
In the main, it was bread was scarce and meat. I would say overall, everything was scarce.
Did you find certain things changed? I mean, did you get different kinds of meat than you would have been used to getting before the war, and different kinds of bread?
I felt that, as my memory serves me today, that I was never really short of food. And I think it ties up with if one's person was industrious, they would get probably more than somebody who was lethargic.
Did the fact that you yourself and a good many of other people you knew who went into the munitions industry had more money with which to buy things?
Yes, that is true. I remember Berenford Square, which is functions today, I think, as a marketplace, stalls and that kind of thing. And they all seem to have had plenty of stuff to sell in the way of fruit and that kind of thing.
Did you feel you had more money in your pocket?
Oh, definitely so, yes.
What kind of things did you do with it?
Coming from, which we say, a very small wage in my first job onto a wage which was sometimes, I think it would be 4 or 5 times greater than I was earning in textiles, thought in the terms of good suits made to measure.
Did you have any particular splashes while you had this money coming in?
Oh yes, I felt that I was having an uplift, as it were. Of course, if one was able to buy new clothes, it gives you a feeling of superiority over as you were, say, two years before.
Now, during this period, when you were working at Woolwich, you were gradually reaching age for military service.
Yes.
And you would obviously have been expecting, once, because the Conscription Act had been passed, you would have been expecting to be called up.
Yeah.
As the time approached when you were getting closer to military service age, what were your personal feelings and reactions and attitude to being called up?
That's quite an interesting question. I was very interested in motorcycling. And I acquired from a friend of mine who'd called up before I was called up a Raj Multi motorcycle, which was quite a popular machine. But it won the Isle of Man Tourist Trophy race in 1914, you see. And I acquired this machine and I became quite interested in motorcycles, going backwards and forwards to the arsenal. So I thought, well, I'll try and get into the forces as a dispatch rider. So I went down to Chatham, to the RE headquarters there, trying to get into the Royal Engineers as a signaller dispatch rider. But they said, no, we're full up with dispatch riders. I'm afraid you'll have to take your turn in the infantry. And that would be relative to your category on your as regards your medical examination. So that was washed out, you see. So now I resigned myself to whatever I was appointed to on my relative to my medical examination.
Now, by this stage in the war, you would have learned quite a lot about things that were going on in France and Belgium through what you read in the newspapers and perhaps from people you talked to or home on leave.
Yeah.
How did you view the prospects of soldiering under war conditions?
There was no indication in the press or whatever one gathers from people you met what you were going to experience if you were sent on active service. In other words, the press weren't allowed to accentuate the bad part of the war. It was more or less glamorised.
But didn't you meet old soldiers on leave and talk to them?
I did, yes.
And didn't they talk about the bad side of the war?
No, they simply said, well, it's pretty rough out there, you know, and that kind of thing. But it was accepted, and it was never brought home to you that it was a very grim business. Whether they'd been prompted not to describe a bad picture to us chaps who'd probably be going out, you see, or not. They may have been, I don't know.
the thing that I was wondering about was this. I know that early on in the war there, in 1914, the reaction to the war was full of patriotism and enthusiasm.
Yes.
I wondered whether, by the time you went into the services at 1916, you were able to detect any changes.
1917.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I wondered if you were able to detect any changes in people's attitudes to the war.
No, I can't say there was. It was accepted as such that you were involved in the war, and there was no element of saying, well, no, I'm not going to do it. You were simply accepted it as another job to do. Mm.
Did you notice when you were serving in France and Belgium any difference there in the attitudes, say, as between volunteers and conscripts, for example?
No, there was no differentiation whatsoever. One couldn't tell. One couldn't tell. You became a number, and you did your job as a soldier.
What was your attitude to COs at the time?
To conscientious objectors? I don't think I ever met any. No, I didn't. I'm sure I didn't.
So you had no feelings about them?
No.
Now, you joined up in the spring of 1917, in April. and were initially attached to the Royal Army Service Corps at Bromley and at Grove Park.
Yes.
How long were you there until you transferred to the infantry?
It couldn't be more than a fortnight or 3 weeks.
What sort of things happened to you during those 2 weeks?
It was simply moving from one particular billet to another. In other words, we had no association with the Royal Army Service Corps as such of learning to drive a vehicle.
Were you surprised by this inactivity?
We were, yes. We were surprised and disappointed.
How did you come to transfer to the Middlesex Regiment?
It wasn't of any application or choice. It was tied up with the particular development of the war. If you were